Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Good morning, everyone, and welcome this morning to Faith Radio Mornings for the 9th of January. If you are in the bitter cold this morning, you are not alone. Where we're broadcasting live from here is the Twin Cities of Minneapolis-St. Paul, and it was 6 degrees in the car thermometer this morning with, I think, gale force winds, Paul Perreault, of about 127 miles an hour. You're the weather guy. Am I exaggerating a bit this morning?
Oh, just a bit.
By about 100 miles an hour, would you say?
More than that. It was only like gust of 20, dude.
No, I don't think I could live on the coast where there's a lot of wind there. I'm your host for the show, Dr.
Try
Peter
North
Kapster.
Dakota, my friend. They had gale force winds of 50 miles an hour. So.
I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. That is for sure. It was just bitter in my car this morning. I'm sure those of you getting up for work this morning, those of you getting ready for school, it's going to be a very cold morning out at that bus stop. And Rachel Sutton, you were homeschooled growing up, and so you probably didn't have to do a lot of standing outside in this kind of wind and this kind of weather.
No, I didn't at all. And then I got to college and everything changed. You're walking across campus and it is cold.
Well, I love it. We were talking yesterday about the fact that my recycle bins that go out on Wednesday morning are likely to be all over the yard in situations like this. And sure enough, Paul, I'm not all that bright. As you know, you've worked with me for a long time now. And the doctorate that I have obviously is overrated on a number of levels. And walking that recycle bin down to the bottom of the driveway last night, the lid flew up from the wind that I think was about 127 miles an hour. And that lid just clocked me directly between the eyes, right on the bridge of the nose.
Ouch.
Went down, a little bit of blood, you know, just to sort of exacerbate the drama of the scene. But, I mean, how do you process that kind of thing when you're laying on the ground, beaten and bloodied and bruised by the wind?
I have no way of responding to that, to be honest.
Well, we're sure glad
you're
we're sure glad you're listening this morning. It's our show here as part of the Faith Radio Network, where we cover the topics and the news of the day from a distinctly Christian perspective. We try to do so through the lens of hope, knowing that we're part of a kingdom that knows no end as we fix our eyes on Jesus together. A little bit of fun, a little lightheartedness, too, as we start our day together. And our first interview this morning is a taped interview that we had with author Christina Fox yesterday, who she wrote a book titled The Idols of a Mother's Heart, which is a really interesting concept, because when I think of idols to which we can attend, we so often talk about the idols of vocation, that we make an idol out of our job, or we make an idol out of money, or make an idol out of success. But she was talking about the sacred profession of parenting, which it is very sacred, and seems like you couldn't make an idol out of something like that. But, Rachel, we were chatting off the air yesterday that was interesting that you really could. You could attend your whole life around the idea of parenting and make an idol out of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think about, like, we spend 8 hours of our day at work, and other people spend their whole day at home with kids. And so if you think about the different idols that we have in life, and I might talk about work too much, and somebody else might talk about parenting or think on it and make it become an idol. And I think really, so understanding where people are coming from and understanding our own idols as we look at this conversation as well.
Yeah, I think it's very important. And Paul, you made a great point that there is a different invitation in the midst of our idolatry, that when we're getting a sense of identity out of something, that really is where we can start surfacing. Maybe we have some idols of the heart.
Yeah. Well, I for me, what really stood out when I saw the article, the initial article with Christine, was, and I've worked on our music side stations, you know, Faith Radio is part of Northwestern Media. We have music stations as well. And a lot of those are targeted demographically to middle-aged women. They have kids. And so we talk a lot about parenting issues between the songs. And there was always that tension of, okay, we want to address these issues, but we don't want to feed into the people finding their identity solely as mom or dad or anything like that. It's a hard thing to do, to be able to speak into their lives through the gospel, but also making sure we're not feeding a misunderstanding of what it is to be a good mom, good dad, or anything like that.
Yeah, it is great. And that's the point of the interview that we'll play up next year as we get started this morning for the 9th of January in Faith Radio Mornings, the idea of how we can really enter into our parenting, but not from a place of idolatry. So welcome, everybody, to the show. More to come next after this break. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. Delighted to be joined on the line at this time by Christina Fox, who's an author, does a lot of writing for different Christian publications, including Desiring God, True Women, ERLC. Set forth a number of books in the past 10-ish or so years, and the most recent one being released in December is titled Idols of a Mother's Heart. Good morning, Christina.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you on the program. As we are sort of looking over this book and some of the premises of it, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about why you wanted to write this sort of book and then give us a little summary about what's in it.
Well, it's kind of the book that I wish I had when I first became a mom, when I first started parenting. It deals with just all those things that come up in our lives and in our heart as we mother our children, and the opportunity it provides us to just really face the contents of our heart in an honest way and come before the Lord with that. Idols of a Mother's Heart is about idolatry, which is obvious from the title. And it just really addresses those things that moms look for life and hope apart from God. Idols that, those things that we worship. So I discuss how we were designed for worship and that if we don't worship God, we will worship something. So I kind of unpack the topic of idolatry and look at specific idols that moms may worship, and then kind of help the reader identify idols in their own heart, and then how to kind of come before the Lord with those, repent of those, and root those out.
Well, and Christina, I would assume there's quite a bit of subtlety, too, in the sense that it might be hard to identify these idols because parenting is such an important and obviously a laudable thing that many of us engage with. And I've got five kids. Do you have kids at home as well?
I have two.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, there really is this mission that is such an important mission, but if we're not careful, we can begin to find our source of life into the mission itself and create some of these idols. So tell us a little bit, as you explored this topic in the book, what you began to find.
Well, I used, let me just say from the beginning that when I was a young mom, I was in a small group with some other moms, and we were reading Tim Keller's book, Counterfeit Gods, together. And it was as I was reading this book that I couldn't help but apply what he was talking about to my own life as a mom. And so I use his definition of idolatry in the book, which is idolatry is anything more important to you than God, anything that absorbs your heart and imagination more than God, and anything you seek to give you what only God can give. So there are about five idols that I address in the book. One is children themselves, how we can even worship the fact that either having children or just finding our meaning in our role in mothering our children. Achievement, success, comfort, control, and approval are the ones that I address in the book. And it is hard because even good things in our lives can become idols, and children are indeed a good thing and a blessing. There are a lot of good things that we can easily turn to. Instead of just appreciating them for the good gift that they are, we then turn to and find our significance and hope in them. And so it is tricky to kind of find that the difference between, is this just something good that I'm appreciating and valuing and as a good gift from God, or is it something that I'm finding my hope in? And that's explored throughout the book.
Yeah, I'd be curious then to get into some of these specific idols. You referenced one of them being comfort. Tell me more about that one.
Well, there's no doubt that there are challenges and difficulties in motherhood. So a lot of times it's easy for us as moms, you know, at the end of the day to turn to something to provide us comfort for our stress or over our worries about our kids. So, you know, it could be anything really, whether it's binge watching something or turning to our favorite frozen treat or escaping, you know, on social media, for example. But, you know, comfort is something that we can all idolize, whether we are moms or not, obviously, but specifically for moms in the midst of the stress and challenges and hardships of daily life in motherhood, we can often find ourselves turning to created things to give us hope rather than turning to God.
Talking with author Christina Fox this morning on Faith Radio Mornings with the book Beware the Idol of Parenting Success. And Christina, I mean, mothers, I don't know if it's unprecedented. I haven't lived over the last 400, 500, 600 years, but it sure does seem like there's a lot of challenges facing mothers and some of the idols that then come along with that, that we pursue instead of finding our life in God. And in some of those pressures, what are some things you've experienced just with raising your two kids that you really sense this is one I specifically fight against?
In terms of comfort or?
Yeah, just any of the idols that you reference in the book.
Well, all of them. I found it a very convicting book to read to write as I was writing it. It was very convicting. All of them. I struggled and still struggle with control at times. I, by nature, don't like disorder and chaos, and that is kind of what comes along with having children. I'm one to kind of live by my plans and to-do lists and my routines and find myself worshiping those and finding hope in life in those things. I'm also one to easily worship success in finding my hope in success in parenting, how my kids are turning out and how they're performing and how that reflects on me and what other people think about that. Comfort, I already mentioned. Approval, I could easily worship wanting my own kids' approval, the approval of others who see what I'm doing with my children and affirm that in me. So, yeah, I can relate to all of that.
Well, certainly writing a book and doing some of this work, it so often is convicting for us first, and I'm sure it comes through in the text as well in terms of just authentically wrestling with this stuff. Well, we'll take a short break here on Faith Radio Mornings and come back with more of Christina Fox. And Christina, I'd like to ask you, as you become aware of the idols in our lives, what are some pathways out of it towards a better sense of wholeness and peace? So more to come on Faith Radio Mornings with Christina Fox. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. We're having an engaging conversation with author Christina Fox this morning, who released a book titled Idols of a Mother's Heart and really references so many of the different kinds of idols to which we can attend, maybe sometimes not knowing about them. Yes, as a mother, but I think as a parent in general and what we pursue related to our kids and our own success. And Christina, as you've thought about some of the idols in your own life, as you've seen some of the idols around us that I think we all kind of engage with, do you have some suggestions and maybe advice for how to begin walking away from those counterfeit gods towards the one true God in our parenting?
Yes. Well, I spent some time first in the book just focusing on heart awareness. And just I think that's the important part to start, is being aware of our hearts. And I provide different questions that we can ask ourselves to kind of probe and explore different idols and how to identify them. And once we've identified them, I then talk about repentance and the need to then turn away from our idols. But in order to turn, we have to turn to something. Because otherwise, an idol can be a lot like a weed where you pull one out and then lo and behold, a few days later, there it is, or another one is there again. And so we need to turn to Christ and grow in our love for him. And, you know, one of the best ways to do that is through the means of grace that we have, through reading his word, praying, studying, being in community with others and learning together. And so I kind of discuss all those different things of just ways that we grow in greater love for our Savior.
And do you find, Christina, that as you do that kind of work and you begin to maybe love God and turn attention to that first, that it actually does impact your parenting in a real positive way?
Definitely. Definitely. You know, we can't help when we love something for it to overflow and for everyone to know about it and for it to radiate out of us and influence those around us. And it will influence our children and certainly affect our parenting and how we respond to them and how we deal with the stresses and challenges that we face.
It's Christina Fox, author of the book Idols of a Mother's Heart. You can be found in all the usual channels at Amazon.com and Target, Barnes & Noble, and so many different places. And Christina, you talked to the first part of our conversation this morning about the idea that this was a book that you wish you would have had as you started this journey of mothering. And I think a lot of young people don't necessarily grow up in the kind of nuclear families that traditionally we've had with a two-parent family and maybe didn't have some of the role models they might have wished they would have had. If you were to turn around and say to a new mother today, these one or two things will really start you on a good trajectory, what might you say to them?
Really, for me, it's just been learning my utter dependence upon God in all things, and that I need His grace to sustain me, and that I don't have it in and of myself. And so that's one of the greatest things. And also just our need for fellowship and community with other brothers and sisters in Christ who can walk alongside us and encourage us forward and even teach us what we need to know, and that we're not, islands out there by ourselves, that we are part of a vast community and family of God, and that we can't do it on our own.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point in terms of being with other people on this journey. And Christina, do you find that sometimes mothers, fathers too, of course, but mothers in this case can be competitive with each other, and that's part of what we need to set down if we're going to live in authentic relationship with each other? Because I find comparing my kids to other kids quite often, and boy, that can be a dangerous game.
Yes, and I do address that in the book. I do talk about the mommy wars, so to speak. And that is a key thing of remembering that we're all on the same journey, but we're also at different stages in the journey as well, and that we can't fight against each other because we need each other.
So if we are finding ourselves in some sort of mommy war kind of situation, as you describe, can you have some conversations with your friends about this, that this is just difficult to be sort of in this comparative game with one another? Or what are some ways in which you can move past that into the kind of interdependent relationships you describe?
Yes, I think that is very important to be able to be open and honest with our friends about our struggles with comparison. I've had those conversations with friends. I think it's also something that we need to be in prayer about with the Lord, and as He transforms us and shows us that our meaning and significance and value and worth is found in Christ, we'll find that we don't have that need to compare ourselves with others anymore.
In terms of bringing your kids up in a church community too, Christina, in these situations and surrounding them with other people too, so that maybe they're not only exposed to us and some of the shortcomings we might have. It seems like today's families are just so busy all the time, whether it's in sports or whether it's in some sort of music situation, whatever it happens to be. How important it is to be part of a faith community as well?
It is so important. It's vital to our faith. That's how God designed the church. I mean, we're called the body, and so we can't, one part of the body can't be missing. If it is, then it doesn't function well. So we need everyone to be together and to be a part of growing the church and living out the church.
We have about a minute left here. And in terms of parenting kids, Christina, you referenced that you have two of them. How important is it as well, or talk about the importance of seeing our kids differently, not maybe just saying, boy, you should be this and this and this and this and this, which can be part of the trap of success, but really seeing them and understanding them as different human beings.
Yes, I have two kids, and they are both unique and different from each other. While they have some similarities, one's definitely an athlete and passionate about it, The other is more of a self-proclaimed nerd, so to speak. And so we've always just encouraged them in what they are interested in, and have definitely tried not to compare them between the two, saying you should be more like your brother or vice versa. So everybody is different, and that is important too.
Yeah, I so appreciate your advice and just thoughts this morning on Faith Radio Mornings. I know the book Idols of a Mother's Heart is something that a lot of people really benefit from in terms of just thinking about those things that are so important to us as we're parenting, and maybe we can look to walk away from them. So, good. Thanks for joining us again. I hope you have a great rest of the week.
Thank you.
Take a break here and come back with more on Faith Radio Mornings. Well, some pretty interesting moments last night. It was the first time that President Trump has held an address directly from the Oval Office. It was about a 9.5-minute speech in which he held steady on his call for a wall along the U.S. southern border. He asked the Congress to fund that wall. He did not declare a national emergency in an effort to circumvent Congress at this time, but there certainly is the shutdown associated with this impasse between the Republicans and the Democrats in terms of border security at the southern border of the United States. And up next on Faith Radio Morning, I'm going to be chatting with Dr. Hunter Baker, who is political science professor at Union University, about the different dimensions of this conversation. Yesterday on Faith Radio Mornings, we were joined by Dr. David Stevens, and he was giving us some tips about the best diets for 2019. And I asked him about the ongoing viability of the old school food pyramid.
The food pyramid's hard to follow. I mean, I know it's been around forever, but simple is good. And learning the type of things you can eat, and then just putting those in your refrigerator and getting the habit and doing it with someone else can make a huge difference in the long run. And don't try to lose a lot of weight in 1 month or 1 week or whatever. I'm going to move my life to a different type of diet. And do that for my family as well, and we'll be healthier and have less heart disease and a lot of other problems that can come from bad diet.
Dr. Stevens had lots of tips and advice relative to diets on yesterday's show, and he suggested that the top diet in which we can enter into for 2019 would be a Mediterranean diet, and had a lot of interesting conversation with him about that. If you want to catch that entire segment, you can go to myfaithradio.com and search for Dr. David Stevens. Up next on Faith Radio Mornings, I'll be joined by Dr. Hunter Baker of Union University, teaches political science there, and we are going to be talking all about the government shutdown and the different sides of the conversation related to the border wall.
A government fiat to kill babies forced on us, period. This is Jim Garlow. I was stunned when the attorney called informing me that our church insurance was now covering elective abortions. How could that be? But he was right. In 2014, a bureaucrat in an office in our state capitol arbitrarily decided that every single insurance provider would pay for the killing of preborn babies. We weren't informed by the state or by our insurance company. And even though religious organizations are not directly paying for sterilization, contraceptives, and abortion, they are covering the cost through a third party, violating our religious convictions. In the months since, our church, along with other churches and Christian colleges in California, have entered into a lawsuit. When the freedom of choice is taken away, infringement of religious liberty soon follows. There's more on this important topic at jimgarlow.com.
Just about 21 minutes before the top of the hour here on Faith Radio Mornings, joined at this time by Dr. Hunter Baker, who's the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Union University and also teaches political science there, regular contributor to Faith Radio Mornings when we have some conversations we need to have about politics. Good morning, Hunter.
Good morning.
So are you back in classes now at Union? Do you have a little bit more time off, or where do you stand after the holidays here?
We are like some schools in that we have a quote-unquote Jan term. So there is a small subset of students who are on campus for the January term, but we'll kick things up for the spring in late January.
Yeah, and that's about a 2.5, 3 hour daily class that you have that focuses on one subject during January term?
They could actually take two classes, each about a half day per day.
Yeah, it's aggressive to be in the classroom coming right back from the holidays like that, whether you're teaching. I'm sure a lot of parents, even with their kids getting back into high school and junior high, it feels like it's quite a wake-up call here at this time of year.
That's right. Well, you know, a lot of Christian colleges, they have an extra few hours because of those New Testament and Old Testament courses. And so a lot of times students need to take those either in January or summer or get extra credits anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's Hunter Baker. If you're listening this morning, he is the Dean of College of Arts and Sciences at Union University. And Hunter, I wanted to chat quite a bit this morning, get your take on this ongoing government shutdown and as well as the wall funding conversation happening between Republicans and Democrats. And last night, of course, we saw a 9.5 minute speech from President Trump, the first time that he's spoken directly to the American public from the Oval Office. What was sort of your general takeaway initially from that?
Well, I don't think it hurt him. I think that he showed some discipline by actually using the teleprompter. I was a little afraid that he would give the address to the nation and then just kind of go on and say whatever he wanted to for 45 minutes or so, something like that.
Yeah, justifiable fear actually, for sure.
So this was actually very disciplined, you know, whether you agreed with it or not, it was disciplined and it was direct.
Yeah, and as he began to try to outline his points for the wall, he began to just talk about the need for it in terms of immigration. But he seems to be shifting his message ever so slightly in terms of the importance of it. And he referenced the flow of illegal drugs. We have a quick clip from that last night.
Our southern border is a pipeline for vast quantities of illegal drugs, including meth, heroin, cocaine, and fentanyl. Every week, 300 of our citizens are killed by heroin alone.
And Hunter, as I've listened to the wall rhetoric, even since he has been when he was running for office in 2015 and then 16, so much of it had to do with illegal immigration, and that then tipped into racial conversation so often for understandable reasons. It seems like he's shifting it a little bit to stop the flow of drugs. That seems like it might be more of a winning political issue for him.
Well, yeah, I mean the original sort of thing was mostly people coming in and taking jobs away from citizens, you know, particularly working class citizens. And you're right, the discussion of drugs as a problem, you know, or even humanitarian concerns, as he alluded to, he is kind of reframing things and trying to maybe soften the edge that I think a lot of people found objectionable.
And he did reach out at one point in the speech, at least it seemed like from a political standpoint, and I'd appreciate just your perspective as one who follows this, that he suggested that the greatest impact illegal immigration has and the drug flow has in our country is within the African American and the Hispanic populations, obviously a voting constituency that he is trying to court.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I did think that section of the speech was a little bit ham-fisted. You know, I mean, to talk about the problems with drugs and I think that he was also talking about economic opportunity as an issue there, but to kind of say, well, these things specifically impact African Americans and Hispanics, that's almost as though you're singling them out as the people who suffer from these social pathologies, and I'm not sure that was great the way he did that. I understand his point though.
Yeah, there's another moment that was at least, and there are several good points, it seemed to me, that he was making, but there's another cringeworthy moment as I was listening, and it had to do with the idea of the reason why wealthy people build walls, and he tried to make the case that wealthy people are not building walls to keep people out and that they hate people, they're trying to protect the people that they love, and that felt like a fairly divisive and maybe some sort of class division rhetoric in my mind.
Yeah, I think it is that, although I will say that, you know, I sort of watching my own social media feeds and it seemed to me like that was the one thing in the speech that I saw more people quote and approvingly than almost anything else in the speech. So I think that does resonate, right? The idea that Nancy Pelosi is wealthy and can have a wall, you know, or Barack Obama, you know, or even the President of the United States. So why doesn't that logic work in other contexts? I think a lot of people sort of intuitively they get that.
And as we saw some response, and we've seen the responses from people like Pelosi and Schumer, one of the points the president has been trying to make as well is that historically, President Obama, Senator Clinton, Hillary Clinton as well, and even Chuck Schumer himself have advocated for the wall in the past. And that's, again, he's going to score some political points with that one, given the fact that in public discourse, they've now changed their position and they don't have a great explanation as to why.
Yeah, I think that a lot of it has to do with sort of a change in the way the Democrats are positioned in American politics. For a long time, they had to kind of straddle sort of a divide between more of their union working class population and then other people who are more interested in sort of identity politics or racial issues or the environment. And that coalition is breaking up. I mean, that explains why Donald Trump was able to thread the needle and win Pennsylvania and Michigan. So the Democrats have in the past certainly talked in that way, but I'm not sure they ever were serious about doing anything.
And then we saw the response from Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi as well post the president's speech as they got equal airtime. And some of the points that they're attempting to make, including Chuck Schumer, is that the president is using the situation as leverage and that we should really divide up the government shutdown from the border security conversation. Here's a quick clip from Schumer.
No president should pound the table and demand he gets his way or else the government shuts down, hurting millions of Americans who are treated as leverage.
It's a fair point from Schumer, but you've been around the block with this too, Hunter, in terms of the suggestion that they go ahead and fund the government to get things rolling again, and then they will have conversations about border security. When there's such a level of impasse, it's pretty hard to believe that they're going to come to a simple resolution on the border security after they fund the government.
Yeah, I think that's true, but I will say that this is a rare case where I have some sympathy for Chuck Schumer because the way that public policy works in the U.S. is that you're able to pass your bills, you're able to do the things you want to do when you win elections. And in our system, that requires that you win the House and the Senate, and you're able to get things done then. I mean, Donald Trump had the House and the Senate and was not able to get his wall going, in part but it's because some Republicans are not in favor of that. And to try to do so now when his situation is less good, particularly with regard to the House, it's a challenge. And, our government is not really set up to pass laws by government shutdown.
And that in terms of passing laws and what he is suggesting, or at least implying that he might do, that being President Trump, is that he would circumvent the ways in which you just described Congress tends to make laws and fund the government. He is at least floating the idea of calling for a national emergency in which then he could appropriate funds for maybe the military or somewhere else to build this wall. Seems like maybe that's why he's shifting the rhetoric over towards the drug flow as a national emergency. Is there any real traction he can get with that part of the argument?
It's a super dangerous game. He is a deal maker. He's clearly gifted at that. He has, as much as people think that, he may be unintelligent or something like that, this is a guy who has made incredibly massive deals in his lifetime, who has survived as a real estate developer all over the world, including places like New York and Chicago. So he knows what he's doing in trying to get a deal. But I think that the whole idea of declaring an emergency and doing it that way has to be mostly a theoretical possibility, because once you do that, once you begin to govern that way, you have opened Pandora's box, and both sides would try to wield that weapon to do whatever they wanted to, outside of the normal confines of our governing process.
Yeah, and certainly breaking the filibuster as they've done in the Senate by reducing the threshold for votes from 60 down to 51, maybe for Supreme Court justices, for other reasons. It does set a precedent moving forward that certainly the other political side, when they're in power, is going to wield as well.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, of course, the Democrats opened the door when President Obama took office on the judicial confirmations, and Senator McConnell was happy to open it further when the need arose.
Hmm. It's the voice of Hunter Baker, who teaches at Union University. He's also the dean of the arts at College of Arts and Sciences there as well. We'll take a short break, Hunter. When we come back, there's a little bit more news coming out of Washington these past 10 days or so, as the House of Representatives has gone under Democratic control and a new set of congresspeople there. And I want to get your take on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's suggestion for a Green New Deal that would fundamentally transform the way we produce energy in our society. So more to come with Hunter Baker next on Faith Radio Mornings. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. We're joined at this time by Dr. Hunter Baker, and we're talking about some of the political conversations coming out of Washington, D.C., including the border wall. The speech that President Trump gave last night and the response from the Democratic side of it. There are more headlines coming out of Washington, D.C. It seems like an endless flow of possible information. And, Hunter, I saw one of the headlines that seems to be batted around quite a bit the last 2 weeks was the proposal from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez for a Green New Deal that would levy up to 70% taxes on the highest earners in our country, but it would also fundamentally transform our society to more of a carbon-neutral society. And, Hunter, in terms of demographically, sociologically, there does seem to be quite a split between the millennial generation and some of the younger generations and their concern over the climate, and maybe other generations where it's a concern, but it doesn't seem to have quite as much energy as the younger younger generation has. What's been your take on this situation?
I think that young people are very interested in the environment. I think that part of that is probably because, especially those who have been to public schools, I think that that has been a very heavy focus in public schools for probably two or three generations now, heard repeatedly. I think that also it is an absolute focus of news reporting. There is constantly speculation about what climate change will do. I recently read a roundup of historians predicting the future, and almost all of them foresaw, you know, major coastal cities being underwater and things like that. If you believe that those kind of consequences are going to follow, then I guess I'm not surprised if you are focused on the environment in that way.
Is there a middle road that we can hew in this situation, Dr. Baker, just in the sense of taking seriously that there is an impact being had on this earth? I think about the ozone layer conversation that I grew up with, and there was a hole created from CFCs that were being generated in the air, and it needed to be dealt with. And from a policy standpoint, we did deal with that. So there is a sense in which there is an impact, but at the same time, without maybe sort of these cataclysmic predictions and apocalyptic predictions that the whole thing isn't going to go down. What, I mean, is there a middle road in this conversation?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the E.F. Schumacher's Small is Beautiful is a great book about this, written, I don't know, late 60s, early 70s. And, he points out that the carbon-based fuels, they will run out, right? Now, you and I, our generation, if you look at the little children's encyclopedias from our generation, they all said that we'd be out of oil by now. The opposite is true. We're far, far away from the frontier of being out of oil, and we don't know how far it extends out. But it will run out. There's no question about that. It's not a renewable resource. It will run out. So for generations in the future, it is something that has to be dealt with. Whether you're concerned about pollution or about climate change or about simply providing for the people of the future, so it makes all the sense in the world to find a way to transition. I think that's what we have in common.
Yeah, I think that is a great middle road point that we need to change it for no other reason than energy won't be available, sometime in the not too distant future. And Hunter, we have about a minute left or so. Regardless of whether there is truth in the climate change conversation or not, the Republicans really seem to be in danger of becoming less and less relevant if they don't address this issue, given the concerns of the next generation.
Yeah, that's true. Although I'm always eager to point out that if you study kind of the free market economists, they all argue the need to deal with pollution. They all say that, look, you know, pollution is a negative externality that is sometimes produced and it has to be paid for. So sometimes some of these free market people are the ones arguing for this sort of thing. It's not just a Democrat-Republican issue.
Well, it certainly is going to bear watching with the change in the Congress and the House of Representatives, and I'm sure it's going to be a major issue over the next 18 months in this political cycle coming up. So appreciate your insight last year in 2018 as we start 2019 to be part of the program like this and help us think through these issues.
Thank you.
Take a break here and wrap up the first hour of our show for Faith Radio Mornings and preview what's coming up in hour two. I always appreciate Hunter's balanced insight when it comes out of the events out of Washington, D.C. He's as dialed in as anyone, given that he teaches this and has to attend to it all week long. Well, up in hour two, we see next we have Bill English. He's already waiting in the green room to come in and have our conversations about Bible and business. He obviously has BibleandBusiness.com. And Bill and I are going to talk about some of the tricky dimensions involved as a Christian employer when you have to let someone go. Is there a Christian way to do that? So more to come in hour two here for Faith Radio Mornings.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.